Okay, this is Ken Samuelson, and I'm here at the Cedars in Chapel Hill with Mr. Tom Carnes, who is a World War II veteran, and we're here to discuss his career during World War II and perhaps a little later. And today's date is July 22nd, and my address is 4019 Farrington Post, Pittsburgh, North Carolina. That's in Farrington Village, and my telephone number is 919-542-0674. And if you could identify yourself, Tom, for the listening audience, I appreciate it.
I'm Tom Carnes, and I'm a resident here at the Cedars. We've been here going almost 4 years now. Mm-hmm. I retired from teaching several years ago. We lived for a while in Austin, Texas.
And where were you born, Tom?
I was born in Wisconsin, Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Kenosha, Wisconsin. And what is your date of birth, Tom?
August 21st, 1914.
Okay. And
born? 93.
93. Okay. You have to be that age to be do everything you've done. Okay, Tom. So born in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Is that where you were raised to?
No. We moved to Illinois. My dad had a hardware store. And I went through from first grade through high school in Oak Park, Illinois.
Oh, yeah, near Chicago. Yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. A suburb of Chicago.
Right.
And I graduated from Oak Park.
And when did you graduate, Tom? You
recall? In 1932.
1932, graduated.
I was 18.
Park. Okay.
Or going on 17.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And went off to college because the dean of our high school liked me. He was a history teacher, and he knew we had no money. And I recall his asking me one day, "Are you going to college?" And I said, "No, I can't." And he said, "Well, if I get you a scholarship, will you go?" So I did. I went 2 years to DePaul University in Greencastle, Indiana. And then I was broke, flat broke. So I laid out, and for the next several years, I would alternate going to school and working. Mm-hmm. Until 1940, I finally graduated.
And where did you work typically when you weren't in school?
I moved to Denver. I wanted to live by myself, and I left my folks, moved to Denver, and I worked for Montgomery Ward. Hmm. They always would hire me back again anytime I showed up. And
that's a long way from DePaul, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
I like the West.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I just always have, still do.
Okay.
And we had been out there one time, and I thought, this is where I want to live.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Denver and got myself a job with Ward's there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would go back and forth from there to Boulder. Mm-hmm. And I graduated from Boulder, technically, I guess, in 1939.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And had no job, of course.
Were times pretty tough then?
Pardon?
Were times pretty tough then to get work?
Very.
Still in a depression, right?
Yes, it was indeed. And I took a civil service exam, which coincidentally my wife had done too. I didn't know her. She lived in Washington, D.C. But by coincidence, we both took the same exam for the Census Bureau. I got the job and went down to Washington in 1940, and that's where we met.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1941, I got drafted.
Oh.
This is May, and we're, of course, greatly upset.
Now, this is prior to
Pearl Harbor,
yeah, before the war, yeah.
And after Pearl Harbor, we decided I'm going to be in the uniform for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So we got married at Christmas time.
I see, in 1941 then?
Right.
Okay. Tell me, from the time that you were drafted then, you got a draft notice, I take it?
Mm-hmm.
Something in the paper, or in the mail, I meant to say. So you got something in the mail saying you were had a report to a particular location?
Greetings, it said.
Greetings, yeah.
Yeah. And this, I was living in Virginia at
Living
the time.
In Virginia at the time.
Working in Washington, D.C.
I see. So that told you to report to what particular location did you have to report to?
Fort Meade in Maryland.
Fort Meade, okay. And this is for basic training then?
For basic training.
And this is in the Army?
Yeah.
Okay. So your basic training, did you have some misgivings about being drafted, or were you...
I hated it.
You hated it?
I hated it.
Okay.
I did everything except go AWOL, but I was lucky. At Meade, they didn't know what to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to brag here, but this is a peculiar situation. They were planning to have a training base down in Georgia for intelligence men. And they were taking everybody with the highest Army General Classification test score.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I stayed at Meade for a month instead of 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And found myself a can of paint and just wandered around the base pretending I was a painter for a month, and I kept away from normal duty that way. But they caught me finally and sent me down to Camp Wheeler, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I got my 13 weeks of training.
So you didn't really do any basic training until you got down to Camp Wheeler?
Right. I didn't learn anything at Meade. How to sneak off the base and go visit Virginia. So
that's amazing. So there was very little to do then. The draft was on, but you had very little to do.
And nothing to do.
Nothing to do, yeah.
And we really didn't have much to do down in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a gun. I had a stick for training with a rifle.
Would you say basically that the equipment left a lot to be desired? In general?
There just wasn't any equipment. We substituted for everything.
Mm-hmm.
We learned to march.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it. How to put a uniform on or salute.
So you're there 13 weeks at Camp Wheeler.
13.
13 weeks at Camp Wheeler, right. And that brings you up to what date then, approximately?
That would have been May or June until the fall.
Still before Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, still before Pearl Harbor, right.
Okay,
and
so
then they were opening up bases all over the country, just overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And
now the draft was going on full-fledged. Yeah.
In fact, a number of fellows I was working in the classification office at Wheeler after I finished my training.
Mm-hmm.
This would be the fall of 41. Some of the men who had been in earlier than I already had a year in and were discharged. I don't know, many people don't realize that today, but some of the draftees were actually discharged before Pearl Harbor because they had their year in.
Hmm.
And then at some point, I think in September or October, Congress passed a bill extending the draft to 2.5 years,
mm-hmm.
or the end of the war, if we got to war.
Now, prior to Pearl Harbor, did you have any knowledge or have any good knowledge of what was going on in the world?
Yes, we did. By coincidence, again, one of the fellows training with me was a Japanese extraction.
Mm-hmm.
And I had known him at Boulder because he was a pitcher, and I was on the University of Colorado baseball team. So we vaguely knew each other. And I remember kidding him regularly about when we were going to go to war against the Japanese. We didn't think much about Germany, but the Japanese scared us. We just were not ready for them, but we thought about it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
So we're approaching Pearl Harbor now, and things are heating up and a little bit, and you're aware of it, I guess, to a degree.
Our chief concern was getting married. When will I be able to get away from the camp?
Mm-hmm.
And Roosevelt did a smart thing, I think. Right after Pearl Harbor, everyone panicked and said, we must get all our troops together and so on. Roosevelt realized we didn't have any facilities. And he thought for morale purposes, the smartest thing would be to let everybody have leave. So thousands of us who were already in service got leave at Christmas time, 1941, simply because they didn't know what to do with us. And then when we came back, barracks were ready, training officers were ready, and we went to work. I went to transfer at that time to Fort McClellan, Alabama, and we went to work immediately there, dealing with these thousands of men coming in.
Tell me, you got married in December of 41. That was a pretty gutsy move for a guy who, what was your buck private or a private, first class, whatever at that time?
I was a PFC.
You had no money, still had no money.
I borrowed money to get to Washington.
was your wife working at the time?
Yeah.
She was working for the Civil Services at the time?
Yes.
For the Census Bureau then?
So? Yes.
So she had a steady job, so she was kind of the one with the income then.
It was pathetic, but it was an income.
Right. Okay, well, you had enough to get married on, and you knew you'd be separated right away anyway, right?
Yeah.
Because you're going to go your way and she's going her way.
I was making $30 a month.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's pretty big dough. That's what a PFC got.
Right. Now, tell me about December 7th. Now, do you recall the circumstances learned about the attack?
It was a Sunday, and it was Sunday afternoon before we heard about the war. And we regularly played touch ball on Sunday afternoon. Oh, 8 or 10 of us. It's a pickup game. And we were playing, and one of the fellas came running out of the barracks. He'd been writing letters home. He came running out, and he said, "The Japanese have attacked us. They've hit Pearl Harbor. Where is that?" And we all said, "We don't know." And since I was the only college graduate, I said, "Well, I know. It's in the Aleutians." That's how much we knew about Pearl Harbor. And some of the men went back in the barracks and tore up their calendars. They had the days marked, how much longer they were going to be in, so on. We were pretty upset. And that's when we got serious about getting married.
Yeah. And your feelings there, you said, "Uh-oh, I'm involved in something a whole lot bigger than me."
Oh, yeah.
That's for sure.
I think everybody realized at that point that this can go on for many years.
Yeah, right.
This isn't just a little fracas. And we better make plans.
So everybody learned about Pearl Harbor very quickly.
So sometime that winter, Virginia came down to Alabama, and we rented a garage, and I was being promoted about every month.
Mm-hmm.
I hit every rank from PFC to top sergeant. I mean, literally every month. She was sewing new steps, new stripes. And at some point, I think tech sergeant or something, you were allowed to live off the base.
Mm-hmm.
So we rented the only thing we could find, which was a garage. It was a nice little place.
Now, what time frame is this now?
This is 1942.
Okay, early 42.
Early 42.
Okay.
On into late 42 and early 43. About a year.
About a year. So what did you do during that year then?
I was a classification non-com.
And what does that work entail?
McClellan would get thousands of troops in every week, recruits. We interviewed them. I had an office of maybe 50, 60 men.
Mm-hmm.
We interviewed everybody who came in, and the theory was to look for specialists of one kind or another and say, "Well, this guy should go here, this one should go here." The truth of it was, most of them were going to go into the infantry anyhow. But we tested them to see what their level was, which ones might want to go to OCS or might be qualified to go to OCS and so on.
So
it was a busy job.
So most of these men, of course, were basically high school grads, some not even high school graduates probably.
Oh, a lot of them. Most of the men we got were black from the South.
I see.
And with very little education.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Some of them couldn't even take the tests.
Yeah.
It was pathetic.
So they're, most of them went into the infantry then, I take it, yeah. Now, backtrack a little bit now, going back to Pearl Harbor, if you don't mind. That day, how did your life in the service change when Pearl Harbor occurred? Were there any directives that you can't do this, you can't do that, you've got to wear your uniform all the time, you got, do you recall?
I don't remember much of that.
You don't, okay.
Most of us had been in 6 months or more. We considered ourselves old veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And saluting and wearing a uniform and those things, we were used to that. That wasn't something new to us.
Mm-hmm.
And the office that I was in was made up of pretty much professional people.
Mm-hmm.
I had maybe 5 or 6 lawyers working for me. And
they were privates, I take it?
No, very few of them stayed private. They got promoted pretty fast.
They were promoting pretty fast.
Okay. And
but you outranked them, obviously.
I outranked them, but time after time, they'd go off to OCS someplace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I guess I remember 30 or 40 of my office went to officer candidate school.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, so you got married, you found this little garage apartment, whatever, to live in, and you, a garage looks like one big room, basically, and they had a little bathroom somewhere, and that was it, huh?
Well, we had a bedroom, a kitchen, a living room, 2 bedrooms.
Oh,
you
did?
2 bedrooms.
Okay. It was a big garage, though. Yeah.
And a kitchen.
Yeah, okay.
It was a nice garage. The owner had made it over long before we came there, had been renting it out.
Now, this is at Fort McClellan again?
This is Fort McClellan.
Okay. And now you were at Fort McClellan doing this work with
this
draftees and so forth.
Classification work.
Classification. Yeah. Did you want to get into something else? Were you?
I wanted to go to officer candidate school.
You want to go to OCS too? Okay.
Otherwise, I was quite happy where I was. It was a good job.
Uh-huh.
And
there was no shooting going on around you anyway.
It would be like this. We might get literally 1,000 men would come in one day,
mm-hmm.
but maybe by Friday there's nobody.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go play basketball or something mm-hmm. for 2 or 3 days
mm-hmm.
till they pour in again.
Right.
And occasionally, if I wanted, I could ship out with them. They had to have somebody on their train. And I took 2 trips with several hundred men. Somebody from our office had to go with them to their new base,
mm-hmm.
and we would rotate the job around. But I did it twice.
I see. So you were there, and did you make an effort then to get into OCS, or
yes.
How did that work?
Yes, I applied, and I went in, must have been about January of 1943
mm-hmm.
that I was accepted for OCS,
mm-hmm.
which was at Fort Maryland.
Fort Maryland?
Fort Washington.
Fort Washington.
Maryland.
Okay.
I was happy about that because Virginia was still living in D.C.,
mm-hmm.
And theoretically, I'd get a weekend off and I could drive up and see her.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you went to OCS, and how long a course was that?
13 weeks.
13 weeks. So, okay. 90-day wonder. Is that?
And it was tough. You worked hard. Didn't learn a lot, but you worked hard.
I went through OCS, too. I can relate a little bit to what you're talking about.
You know.
Okay, so A lot of book work, a lot of history and tactics, and what all did you do at OCS? I know what I did.
We drilled more than anything.
Drilled more than anything.
We marched and marched and marched.
Oh.
And we had some tests.
Did you have much time off while you were at
no.
OCS?
No. We were supposed to. But one of the companies had an epidemic of, and as a result, they couldn't do the normal duties.
They had
guard,
the
KP, and so on. Mm-hmm. And we substituted for them week after week. And in the 13 weeks, I probably got about 4 weekends off, which I would spend with Virginia.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, did you have any inkling, or did you have any opportunity to ask what you wanted to get into and so forth?
This was Adjutant General School.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty highly rated, I guess, because when we graduated, we were given a good deal of latitude of where we might go. And I said, well, I'd like to go into the Air Force. One thing I didn't want was the infantry.
Uh-huh.
I said, I'd like to get into the Air Force, and I'd like to be assigned to some base in the West.
Okay. Let me ask a question about the Adjutant General. Tell me, for those who don't know, tell me about what the duties are for someone who attends the Adjutant General and goes on into the service.
Well, the odd duty is they ran the post office.
Okay.
Their major duty was simply administration. And let's say that President Roosevelt wanted such and such an order issued, the Adjutant General of the Army would issue it. His name would be on it.
I see, okay.
I was an adjutant in the bomb group that we'll talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But up here someplace in Washington is an Adjutant General.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Who would be a 2 or 3 star general. But it's administration.
He's the top administration guy, the Adjutant General.
Right.
Right. Okay, good. That helps us all. Okay, so you wanted to get into this administration, an adjutant.
And I got what I wanted.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then my order said Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. And I thought, gee, this is great. I like Salt Lake.
Now, what time frame is this when you graduated?
This is April of 43.
April of 43 is when you graduated, okay.
And we saved up on our gas coupons and used the military orders and got permission to drive from Washington to Salt Lake. Stopped off and saw my folks who were still in Oak Park.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a nice trip out.
Mm-hmm.
We got to Salt Lake City and I found out that that was not the base. That was just the assignment center. And my assignment was Wendover Field, Utah.
Right.
120 miles farther west out on the desert. We had a time there for a few days with housing because I discovered that they wouldn't let Virginia on the base.
Wow.
Unless she had a job on the base. So she's living in Salt Lake for a while with the car, and I'm at Wendover, locked in, so there.
Now, Virginia working then?
But I've already gone to work as the assistant base classification officer.
And Virginia's just waiting to get a job.
She's waiting for a job.
Right, okay.
And she will raise the hair on your neck telling you about how she drove from Salt Lake to Wendover. Have you been there, by the way? Do you know Wendover?
I've never been to Wendover, no.
Well,
I've been to Salt Lake.
Are you familiar with the Bonneville Salt Flats?
Well, yes, generally, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this was a lake at one time, a huge lake. It's now a little bitty lake with a lot of salt, and nothing grows.
Mm-hmm.
And 90 of the miles are absolutely straight. Our car was pretty good, but the tires were bad. And to this day, she still holds that against me, that she had a flat tire on the way.
Oh,
here she is out in the middle of the desert trying to change it. Fortunately, some GI came along and helped her out. But anyhow, she finally did get a job on the base. And that permitted her, she lived in barracks here, and I lived in barracks over here half a mile away. As assistant base classification officer.
Now, she lived there, you say, or worked there?
She lived in a barracks and worked on the base.
Uh-huh.
So she'd walk over and we'd have breakfast together.
And where were you living?
In another barracks right on the base. Oh, they wouldn't. Between us is a highway and a railroad.
Now, they wouldn't let you live together, though.
No. Okay. Nobody could live together.
Oh, okay.
Simple reason, there was women barracks and men's barracks.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of the women were single.
Yeah. Okay. Now, these were all non-military women, I tell
you? Right.
There were no WACs there?
Not that. Whatever. Some came later, but at that moment, there weren't any.
These were basically wives?
These are wives, yeah, girlfriends.
With some single girl who worked on the base.
Right.
Okay, so you were at Wendover, and how active a base was Wendover?
Very.
And what were they doing at Wendover?
We were training bomb groups.
Okay.
B-17 and B-24s. And briefly, we had some fighters, some P-47.
Uh-huh.
But mostly it was the bomb groups, because this is, again, a geographical matter. It was ideal for a gunnery range. You could drop your bombs any place and nobody's going to get hurt. And the same with the gunnery range, which was up in the mountains off to the side of the salt flats. And the gunners could shoot off at target planes and so forth there, mm-hmm, quite safely.
Yeah.
So it was very, very isolated. No town. Wendover was just a couple of stores and a hotel.
The thing of the salt flats and the sand and everything out there, what did that do to your planes, though? It must have been a bad place for aircraft maintenance, was it not? Or?
I never heard them complain about the salt.
Or the sand and the wind, you know.
Somehow or other they coped with it. I don't know. I never heard anyone say that it was disturbing them.
Tough on the planes.
What they really liked was the space.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Of course, the government was buying up all the cheap land everywhere. And most of the 2nd Air Force bases were out in the desert somewhere.
Uh-huh.
Utah, Wyoming, South Dakota, right. Idaho, all over. Just wherever you could buy useless land, we'd build an air base.
Yeah. Now, were you a pretty busy guy then with a lot of squadrons coming through?
I was pretty busy. Each bomb group would be ready to go to war, except they needed some more training. But there would always be members of the group that would be washed out or didn't want to go or were a problem in one form or another. And all of those were dumped in my lap. But mostly our job was to see that the group was filled up, that it had the requisite number of pilots, radar operators, and so on.
Now, did you have to bring replacement men in from other bases then to fill out a squadron? And
whatever? They came in quite often.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, what did you do with the guys who failed?
Ship them out back to Salt Lake. Most of them ended up in the infantry.
Okay. So some might have been officers too, right?
Yes.
And so they were demoted, or were they going as an officer in the infantry?
They could be both. Could be either one.
Depending upon what the problem.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So you were very busy with these squadrons and taking care of these guys who didn't make it. And when did that activity start to tail off? Or is that a fair thing to say?
We were at Wendover from April of 43 until the summer of 44. And I'm guessing it would be about August. But I'm not sure. But it was summer. We didn't have anybody to train. Nobody was coming in. No groups were coming in. We were finishing up two or three bomb groups who would take off for Europe, but nobody would replace them. And we, all of us who had been there a while, were a little bit worried. We thought the base was going to be closed.
Mm-hmm.
And
let me ask a little historical type question, I guess. Now, at that point during the war, how do you account for the fact that the demand for the squadrons was tapering off? So what was happening around the world that would cause that to happen? Do you know?
I don't know to this day. Unless, and I'm giving the brass more brains than they deserve, maybe, unless somebody in Washington is saying, we've got two or three bases out in the West, and one of them maybe for the 509th. Let's clear them out.
Oh, okay.
Let's get rid of all the other guys over there.
It might have been just Wendover that was...
I don't know that.
Yeah.
That's my surmise.
Yeah, okay. But that could very well be.
Let me tell you one quick story about Wendover.
Okay.
Before the 509th came. This was terrible. A B-24 was coming in for a landing with one engine out, and the pilot was having a lot of trouble just a few miles from the base. And ultimately he crashed and landed on the railroad tracks, splitting them, and the plane bounced around all over the desert. Awful. Everybody was killed. Within minutes, a big freight train comes and hits these tracks that are spread so, and the train leaves the tracks. It was the biggest mess you ever saw in your life. I happened to be on the accident board at the time, so I was called out to go see it, and nothing, of course, I could do. But it was just awful. And the weird thing about it, how fast news travels, the freight train was loaded with supplies for a naval base in San Diego. Clothing, food, beer. And before I got there, and I got there in a hurry, GIs were out there doing just what you figured they'd do. Loaded up with all the supplies from that train.
Oh, gosh. Then you got this.
It's just not a very
and
nice
And it all
story.
Happened basically within...
Within minutes.
Minutes of each other, yeah. So you got this dead crew, and then you got the scavengers and...
This is awful.
Yeah.
I was on this board because every accident had to be investigated by a pilot, a maintenance man, who would always be at odds, and I'm the neutral.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got on a lot of... And I was also on the... court-martial board, and we had a lot of that, a lot of AWOL.
Oh.
Nobody liked Wendover.
Well, AWOL, now, I guess a lot of the folks had cars, is that right?
A few. They'd hitchhike.
They'd hitchhike, because I was going through my mind.
And there was a bus.
Oh, okay, so you could get...
The MPs regularly stopped the bus to see who was on it.
Ah, yes. Nobody liked Wendover.
No.
Well, there's nothing to do there, I guess, or because it was...
We had a swimming pool, outdoor swimming pool, and in the little village of Wendover is a Hotel Wendover, which was on the state line.
Mm-hmm.
So you could go up there and gamble. In Utah, you couldn't gamble, but if you got in the right part of the hotel, you could play the slots.
In Nevada, I see.
In Nevada.
Yeah, right, okay, I see. Amazing.
Weird. And you could get liquor.
So, just to digress just a second, what did you do for any recreation there? I mean, you just worked all day and all night, or what?
For recreation, we swam and went to the movies, which were, I think, about 10 cents.
Yeah, so you had movies.
We had a lot of movies.
That was about
That was it.
Yeah.
When you were lucky, you got a weekend in Salt Lake.
Uh-huh.
And we loved Salt Lake, of course.
Okay. Okay, so things were winding down. I think you mentioned me when we talked that you were wound up being the highest ranking officer at the airbase, right?
Yeah, I was a captain.
And how did that happen? How did that shake out?
There probably were five or six officers who outranked me, including the base commander and his deputy.
Right.
And all of these guys knew more than I did. Now, they didn't know the 509th was coming, but they knew that this place was in bad shape. And there was a bit of an old boy network, and they would get in touch with Captain So-and-so over in Alamogordo and say, hey, see if you can't find a spot for me.
Yeah, right.
Or some of them just took leave.
Mm-hmm.
So the base was almost deserted of high-ranking officers. Well, it was deserted.
Yeah.
We weren't maintaining or anything.
Yeah, it wasn't good for their careers, I guess, in that base.
Yeah, some of these men wanted to be regulars, you know.
Yeah, sure.
They weren't all draftees like me.
So eventually all the officers who outranked you were transferred and so forth?
They're gone.
They're gone.
At least physically not there.
How many would you say were left on the base? How many people were there when you were on the
of all rank?
Yeah, just total.
Oh,
yeah.
1,000 or more.
Still 1,000 people there. Well, that's still
doing nothing.
Yeah, still a lot of people though.
For 3-4 weeks.
And did you get any guidance from anybody as to what was going to happen?
Just all we did was make up rumors.
Yeah.
None of us knew.
You didn't know that, obviously, that you were in the running for the base for the 509.
No.
Yeah, so you wouldn't know that.
My guess is that they were going to close the base.
Yeah.
That's the way it looked. I couldn't figure out why. This is 1943. Why would you close an air base?
Yeah.
But I couldn't see any other reason.
Right. Okay, so what time frame is this now we're talking about when things
this
really...
This is late summer of 43.
Okay, 44 or 44?
44.
44, okay.
When I told you over the phone, this big airplane flew in, and all of us went out of the office to see it. We'd never seen a B-29. It landed, and a few minutes later, the pilot came up to my office. It's just one of those strange things. If everybody else hadn't been there, I don't know what would have happened. But I was the boss, so he came to me, and just as a courtesy, said, "I would like to take a look at your base." And I thought, here's a lieutenant colonel with all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, right.
What the heck? Let him see the base. There's nothing secret here. So I got him a Jeep, and he went off by himself, drove all over, came back, said thanks, and took off. He came back about, I'm off here, but 10 days to 2 weeks later, he comes back again. Looks for me. And at this point, he starts talking about the 509. He's pretty vague, but he said, in general, I am going to have a very unusual bomb group training here. He'd been given a choice of three bases, and he chose Wendover. And he said, I'm going to be very busy flying, testing, going back and forth to Washington. He said, if what we do succeeds, the war will be shortened by 2 years. That's the only thing I ever learned.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, that's good. He said, you want to be in it?
He gave you a choice.
I said, sure. Sure. Yeah, he had no control over me. I was in another organization.
Yeah, right.
He said, I'll make you my adjutant. And I said, yes, sir. Fine with me. He said, you have any questions? I had a stupid one. I said, I don't want to go overseas by boat. He said, you don't have to. He said, I'm going to have my own taxi service. We had five C-54s. And if anybody of significance had to be any place, he got a ride in a C-54 or a B-29.
Yeah, right.
So...
Okay, now
that's how I met.
Of course, you
Paul
haven't.
Tibbetts.
Yeah, you haven't mentioned. You just mentioned his name, Paul Tibbetts. Okay, that was Lieutenant Colonel Paul Tibbetts. And did he give you the name of the project at that point?
No, he did not.
He did not. Okay.
He just said that he would have great priority over anything he wanted. I didn't know the name of it.
Right. Okay. Now, when did he actually start bringing people in, and what was your job when he started bringing people in?
Okay, they started bringing them in that fall. And
sometime in September, I guess.
September, probably.
September,
yeah.
44, I think. It was.
And if I remember right, the first people who came in were his crew. Van Kirk and Lewis and
Farabee
and Dusenberry had all flown with him in Europe.
Right.
And he wanted to keep them together. And so he made, I don't know if you what you know about a group table of organization, but there's a commanding officer up here and his deputy and various people, but he also has a group navigator and a group bombardier, and they're supposed to be the best. Mm-hmm. And it is their job to train the other bombardiers and navigators. And so he was bringing in his most experienced men. These men had had 50 missions in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the B-17.
Right.
So all they had to do was learn to operate a B-29.
Now, how many B-29s wound up being at Wendover Field?
We had 15.
15. Now, of course, on the mission, you know, to drop the bomb, there were basically three that...
Actually, we used two only dropped bombs.
Yeah. Boxcar and
there were on each mission there were other B-29s photographing and so forth.
Yeah, in fact, two of the planes that were with on that mission were of the third photographic squadron that I'm talking to you about on this other guy. Were the weather planes.
Yeah.
Two or three of them were weather planes.
That's right.
And then you had your photo plane, and then you had your instrument plane, and then you had the Enola Gay. Is that correct?
I think so.
Yeah. Okay.
The weather planes went first. They were over the neighborhood naturally.
Right. Mm-hmm.
First.
Seeing what the weather was like. Okay. Well, now when did do you recall when these planes where you really started to crank up and get busy on the training of the 509th? Was that shortly after September?
That's in the fall of 44.
Okay. Now, what did you know about anything?
Not much. All I knew is I do whatever Tibbetts asked me to do.
Yeah.
I didn't ask any questions. I knew that there were some bases where we were doing some secret things.
Uh-huh.
He took me on two or three of them for one reason or another. And they wouldn't let me off the airplane.
Uh-huh.
So I knew something was going on.
Right.
They wouldn't do that. And I his office is like, say his, there's mine here. I know when he's gone all the time. And he would say to me, I'm going to Y.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know what in the world Y was. But I knew it was a secret base someplace.
Yeah.
And that's all I would know. But he told everybody, he had a meeting, he had Wendover, which was smart. He told everybody there, he said, you don't have to be here if you don't want to. If you want to get out now. But he said, we are going to, he didn't ever mention the word weapon or bomb. He just said, we have the capability of ending the war 2 years early. And he said, don't ask any questions. Don't spread any rumors. Just shut up and do your job.
Now, talking about security now, what were you... Now, I've read some stuff about this and what went on with the 509th. From a standpoint of speaking to other people about anything that might be relating to what you were doing, could you sit around in any place and just shoot the breeze about what you were doing, or was that forbidden?
That's forbidden.
Okay.
And a bunch of guys did it.
And what happened to them?
I didn't know this till after the war, but we had more than 30 intelligence men.
Mm-hmm.
One was a waitress at the Hotel Utah, believe it or not.
A man?
No, a woman.
Yeah, okay.
I knew their head because he talked with me every day. Mm-hmm. But I did not know that he had a whole gang working for him.
Mm-hmm. So there
were civilians.
Men and women there doing
it. Men and women.
Okay.
And what would happen is, say a couple of guys would be on furlough in Salt Lake City and they go to some restaurant and they're just sitting around talking. And if you mentioned, I'm at Wendover and I work on the B-29, and one of these men heard it, I'd hear about it the next day and you'd be gone. The classic example, and most of the men never knew this, was so quick. But Tibbetts had a deputy, young B-29 pilot, lieutenant colonel. And I don't know to this day what he did, except Paul said he talked too much. At any rate, one morning he came in to me and he said, get Lubke as far out of Wendover as you can send him. So I got in touch with the 2nd Air Force and we shipped him to the Aleutians. Just talked too much.
Yeah.
We had a whole MP squadron, 100 men. Really, we didn't need that many, but they were there all the time. And they spent a good deal of their time maintaining security, not just in Wendover, but in the little towns where people would go for their furlough.
So what were you actually, you were training this, these men were being trained at the time. Now what were they,
okay,
how are they being trained, what were they being trained in? They were all flight crew.
We had one squadron, 15 pilots,
uh-huh,
and their crews from Nebraska. Tibbetts thought they were the best he could find. They were transferred to Wendover, and they, of course, immediately hated all of us because nobody wanted to come to Wendover. But what they got was training with a new kind of bomb. They were ready to go to war already, but they were coming to Wendover to learn what you do when you drop this particular kind of bomb. What were the ballistics of it? Now, I don't know what each crew was told about the bomb, but I'm sure they figured out at some point, hey, we've got some super bomb. It was much bigger and heavier.
Did they have a mock-up of...
If so, I never saw it.
Little Boy, right, was the first one?
Little Boy and Fat Man.
Yeah.
Fat Man.
Which one was the first one?
The first one was the Fat Boy.
Okay.
I forget.
Okay, anyway. Did you have a mock-up of a bomb that would look like the actual...
I never saw it if we did.
You never saw it. Well, it just puzzled me how they could be trained and not use a mock-up of what they're going to be dropping. Or did they have something...
They were dropping dummy bombs, of course.
Yeah.
And I'm not real sure...
What they look like and
They look like. It could be... I guess you could do this. The danger of the 509th bomb was to you. And it may have been that what they were learning was how to drop it and get out of there as fast as you possibly can.
Make your U-turn and get
making the turn.
And, get out.
And it didn't make a lot of difference what the bomb was that they dropped.
Uh-huh. Okay, we're going to pause here.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape A, side two.
Okay, so they were training a lot of how to handle the aircraft in an unusual situation,
right.
Bombing run. So basically it was not the normal bombing type run.
I thought of another answer to your question too. It's time. These men coming from Nebraska thought they were going to Germany or Europe.
Mm-hmm. Coming to Nebraska or to Salt Lake?
They were coming from Nebraska to Wendover.
Yeah, okay.
And they thought they were supposed to be in England, and here they are in Wendover. Well, from Wendover, they get over water navigation training,
mm-hmm,
which nobody else was getting. And our planes all flew, every pilot had to fly to Cuba and back, just so they would get some experience over water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that should have been a clue to almost anybody. Hey, we're not probably going to Germany if we're going over a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, Tibbetts told me, more than he intended to probably, that ultimately we were to have a double organization, depending on the war. One 509th group might go to Europe and one to Asia.
Mm-hmm.
But it took so long for the bomb to be ready that it was decided it was not necessary in Germany. And one was
early May.
So after that, we knew where the war was.
Well, are you saying that there was a possibility that a bomb would be dropped in Germany?
Oh, yes.
That's the first I've ever heard that.
Yeah.
That's the first I've ever heard that.
I got it straight from Tibbetts.
Okay.
He's, and I think it's in his own book. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, okay.
But he said there was a strong possibility of it. I had a big argument with some other historians about this, because they've always contended that the 509th was racist. And I said, absolutely not. We didn't hate the Japanese any more than we hate the Germans. It just happened that the German war was under control by the time we were ready to go.
Right.
But we did not know for sure where we were going until the winter of 45, when we were issued summer uniforms. When I got a whole brand new...
Winter of 44 or winter?
45.
Winter 45, okay, because the bomb was dropped on August 6th, right?
Yeah.
45.
This would be, say, December of 44, January of 45.
Okay.
I got summer uniform.
Okay.
And I thought, well, I'm not going to Germany in a summer uniform in January.
Uh-huh. I see. Okay. So, anyway, you're training, and what are your duties then? Of course, you're doing the paperwork for Tibbetts and...
I'm his adjutant, so I'm doing anything he feels like. But primarily, what I was doing, and the most interesting thing, we were filling up the group. The table of organization called for 1,900 some men.
Mm.
Most of these were routine jobs, like the MPs. An MP can be an MP anywhere. So we just took them from Wendover. And I would transfer maybe 200 men a day from, let's say, a supply office to the 509th supply office.
Mm-hmm.
That was simple. That was a clerical job. But then each division commander, squadron commander, would at some point or other say, I need such and such.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most of these were engineers or very well-trained technical men who knew somebody by name that they wanted. And they would come to me, or Tibbetts, say, I want so-and-so at such-and-such. Well, what was fun was that sometimes this guy would be a professor, or he might be in the Navy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And none of them wanted to come. But they came by order of the president. If we said Joe Blow teaching at MIT is essential to the 509th, we got him. And you could tell right away after they were there because they didn't know how to put a uniform on.
Yeah, this is a civilian.
These are civilians.
Yeah, civilians come. Okay.
And we were still getting them on Tinian. It was kind of fun to see them.
So this is like a bolt out of the blue to some of these guys.
Yes.
You're wanted at Wendover Field and you got to go.
Especially, I think, the Navy men hated it.
Yeah. But that of course, the Navy men actually became part of the 509th.
Right. Not many, maybe three or four.
But they were in the Air Force table of organization then.
Of course, there were a couple of high-ranking men in the Navy. Captain Parsons...
Right.
Ultimately an admiral. He wore a Navy uniform all the time.
Right.
I remember him.
Yeah.
And a man died the other day. Ken Ashworth was a commander and an authority on some aspect of bombing.
Mm-hmm.
And... So they were just sort of attached to us. They didn't join the Air Force.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I remember we did have two or three regulars, Navy.
But they all had a job to do. Now tell me about the security as things went along then, as you progressed further on the project. What happened? Any change in security, or did it become more intense? And
oh, it was beat in your head the day you arrived. If a man, if let's say an enlisted man, was transferred into the 509th, the first thing I did to him when he came into my office would be to tell him about security. Mm-hmm. That was my part of my job. Keep your mouth shut. Mm-hmm. And they did. One fella came from Tennessee. What's the name of that place where they were building part of the bomb?
Oh, yeah, okay. I can't.
Oak Ridge.
Oak Ridge, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I said, I see you came from Oak Ridge. He said, no, sir. I've got the record in front of me. I said, are you sure? I'm not allowed to say. He wouldn't even admit he had been to Oak Ridge, and I had it in front of me. So
you congratulated him on that.
Yes, I did. And my chief sergeant major told me he went on leave way up in the wilds of Montana. He was a farm boy, a ranch boy. And he said somebody followed him all the way on the train, all the way up into the place of Montana, and followed him all the way back. Stayed there in this village until my man left and came back to Wendell. It was intense. So and there were signs all over the place.
Yeah.
What you do here, what you see here, when you leave here, let it stay here,
yeah.
Some such thing.
Right. Okay.
Slogans.
Now, somewhere along the line here, as you're training, you continue on your training, but the bomb is exploded at Alamogordo.
Right.
Do you learn anything about that?
No, all I knew was that Alamogordo was a place that they wouldn't let me off. A lot of secret things were going on there, and that there were scientists there, mm-hmm. Who occasionally came to Wendover. Mm-hmm. I met them.
Mm-hmm. So this...
What's his name? I never met
Oppenheimer. Yeah.
But I met most of his deputies. They'd come into Wendover for a day or so or something. Uh-huh. And I'd be, it's part of my job to put them up, find a place for them,
yeah.
Feed them and so on.
Right. Okay, so the Alamogordo explosion, nobody knew beans about that.
Never heard it.
Never heard of it until later.
I got out of the Army.
Yeah, okay. So, you're somewhere along the line here, you go overseas.
Right.
Along about May, I think, of 45, you go.
Right.
And how do you get there?
Most of the men were going to go by ship. Mm-hmm. So they left 3 weeks ahead of us. The poor guys, they were on the water a long time.
Yeah.
By way of the Philippines. Awful. I went on the first C-54. With the supply officer, the finance officer, the mess officer, the men necessary to set up the base. The base was there. We didn't build that. The Seabees built it, mm-hmm. with tents. And one of my jobs was to assign people to tents. It should have been simple, but I put the chaplain in with this Red Cross man, and they had a fight. I had to send the Red Cross man home. He was a drunk, alcoholic. But anyhow, we got there 2-3 weeks before the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Get everything settled, and then the ship comes in with the whole gang of men.
Mm-hmm.
And then the B-29s start trickling in, maybe one every other day or so.
Now, Tinian was a hotbed of activity anyway, wasn't
it? Oh, yes.
I mean, there were planes, bombing missions.
A lot of bombing from there already before we got there.
Yeah, right. So you had to, somebody had to make room for you because
yep.
This was a special group coming in.
Yeah.
And how did they, were you isolated from the rest of the
yes.
people on Tinian?
The other men couldn't come on our base.
Okay.
We were on one end, the north end of the island.
Okay.
And there are jeeps and streets all over the place. I could go to a movie 3 miles away if I wanted to. But nobody could come onto our airbase.
But you were allowed to go off, though.
We could go wherever we wanted.
You go where you wanted, okay.
And the other bases, the other groups did not like that at all.
Yeah.
Naturally.
Well, they knew you were special, and right. They didn't know why.
And a lot of our men would go around and say, well, we're going to end the war.
Oh.
And people didn't like that.
No. Well, they shouldn't have been saying it anyway.
No, they shouldn't have said that.
Tell me about the B-29 now. They had a lot of problems with the B-29. Mm-hmm. Did you have some special B-29? Were they brand new, for example, or did they have any special characteristics for this particular mission?
Well, you ought to talk to Tibbetts about that, because that was that's what kept him so busy.
Yeah.
He was one of the first people to test it. You may remember, they were built by Boeing, and Eddie Allen, does that name ring a bell? He was number one test pilot in the country, probably. And he crashed and was killed, a B-29, shortly after they first went into production. Mm-hmm. And a lot of men were afraid of it.
Yeah.
But,
well, I understood that, and this is something I just read, that apparently didn't have reversible props.
No,
And Tibbetts arranged
Did that. We were the first planes to have that.
To have reversible props because of the danger taking off. You want to be able to stop
in a hurry. I'll tell you a quick story about that if you want.
Sure.
The war may have been over, I'm not sure, but at some point, the war wasn't over. I'm sorry. Orders had been issued from the 2nd Air Force that all the B-29s were to drop their bombs from 10,000 feet. This was General LeMay's order.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we couldn't, of course. So Tibbetts decides to go to see LeMay, who was on Guam. And for reasons I don't know to this day, he asked me to come along in the Enola Gay.
Mm-hmm.
So we went over there, and I sat out in the lobby listening. I could hear low voices. And at one point, I heard LeMay scream. And then I think a long phone call, they got hold of Hap Arnold. The gist of it being simply that nobody had told LeMay who we were. And that made him madder than anything.
Yeah.
He didn't care what height we flew at, but he was mad. Well, the interview ended, they got it straightened out. Tibbetts picks me up, we go back to the plane. And he's in it, and I'm starting to get in, and he said, Tom, you see those GIs in front of the building, the barracks, the hangar? Tell them they better move away. So I did. I went over. There were about five or six loafing around doing nothing. And they wouldn't go. They shuffle a little bit, but, you know, who's this officer? We don't know him. And I come back and get in the plane, and I said, they don't want to leave, Paul. And he said, all right, it's their problem. Well, these are the reversible pitch propellers. They didn't know an airplane could back up. It was the most fun that I had the whole war, was watching all the dirt and the coral and the sand hit these guys, and three or four of them fell over as we were backing away. And he said, you're supposed to take orders.
So they wished that they had moved when you said move.
Anyhow, these were the first reversible pitch ever anywhere used that I know of.
On the B-29.
On the B-29s. All of our planes ultimately were to have them.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And he modified ours. Well, I used to hear the word modify every week. I'm going to Florida, or I'm going to Seattle, I'm going to do this to modify something. What he wanted was a big bomber that was fast and could turn in a short radius. I didn't understand that. And he would do anything to do that. Well, he took off the gunners. kept just one. And the other B-29 commanders thought we were crazy. But he said, we're not going to have any problem with guns. We really didn't. We didn't need any, but we didn't know that. So you probably could find it if you wanted to. But a lot of modification was done to our planes that was not done to others.
Mm-hmm. Of course, now tell me, what do you know about the potential for a crash on takeoff? Do you recollect any conversation about that? Because that's a very real potential.
Well, it was very real, but I don't remember one. There were a couple of crashes at Wendover. I mean, when we were at Wendover, but they didn't happen at Wendover.
Yeah.
One bomb tore loose over California someplace, created an awful mess, but nobody got hurt.
Yeah.
But I don't remember any occasion.
But there was,
it could have happened.
There was a potential, though. Let's say that plane started going down the runway.
Oh, yeah.
And you bet. And what was there any conversation about what would happen if that plane carrying the atom bomb had to abort on takeoff?
That had everybody scared, even before we knew it was an atomic bomb. We didn't want to be on the same island with whatever that thing was.
Yeah.
And, it's a small island, miles long.
It would have taken the whole thing out.
It would have taken,
the whole plane.
It would have wiped out the Second Air Force.
But, of course, and I don't want to go too fast here, you may have something else you want to say, but getting into close to August 6th, what did you feel? Anything that was going news or any change in conduct or
well, security? The only thing that I noticed
as you approached that day,
I noticed the people, and we were every day we were getting every few days we were getting a new newspaper man.
Uh-huh.
Or a scientist from someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't have any idea why they're there, except I knew they were there. I had to know they were there. I was the one little bolt that made sure they ate.
Yeah.
And if I had known these men, it would have been more important, if I'd known who they were. Now, William Lawrence from the New York Times came.
Uh-huh.
Well, he was a great science editor. I didn't know that. I knew him. And I wondered, who is this funny-looking little guy? Why is he here? And he had a deputy. Well, why does a newspaper man need a deputy? And then a scientist would come in, probably from Alamogordo, I don't know, spend a day or two and take off again. That's all I know.
I can understand the scientists coming in, but how about the newspapermen? They had to have a reason to come to Tinian. And how could they possibly have learned anything that would cause them?
I think simply that...
Or even get the authority to go to Tinian.
The Air Force headquarters simply said, hey, you want to have a newspaperman there.
Oh, this is getting close to August 6th.
Yes.
This is real close.
Yeah.
Okay. This is not months before or anything.
No.
This is just...
No, I never saw any at Wendover.
Yeah, they wouldn't let them in there. And nor would they let them on Tinian, I guess, unless they knew that you needed one there for what was going to happen. Okay. So getting close then to August the 6th, then, did you ever see the atom bomb?
Mm-hmm.
You never saw it. Okay.
No.
And how was it delivered? I know in the part of the Indianapolis delivered the fissionable material and all this stuff. And that came up to Tinian and unloaded, right?
It came and left the bomb. I gather it was a bucket kind of thing.
Right, yeah, bucket.
Left
right.
It and then took off for the Philippines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was sunk the next day or two, if I recall.
That's a whole other
story. We knew it. We heard it. It didn't mean much to me, but I knew that the ship had been sunk,
yeah,
and that it had something to do with us.
Yeah. So you never actually saw, I guess that was top secret in a big container of some kind.
No.
Nobody ever saw it except a few
just
people.
The men who absolutely had to.
Yeah. So that was really... So you still had really no idea, or maybe you had some thought going through your mind as to what was going to happen?
I didn't have a very good idea. Most of us, by the time we left Wendover, were pretty well imbued with keeping your mouth shut. Don't ask questions. I just didn't.
Just do your job.
And do your job. If somebody wants me to know something, they'll tell me. I remember one man, a rather smart fellow, a good friend of mine, said one day, "I figured out what we're going to do." I said, "Oh." He said, "Yeah." He said, "We have an atomic bomb. We've split the atom. We're going to drop an atomic bomb." I said, "No way." I said, "The scientists have been trying to split the atom for 50 years. If they'd split it, we would know about it by now." And he said, "Well, you're probably right."
Could you tell the pace of activity? I mean, talking about just a few days before, you know, the bomb. Could you tell by the pace of activity that something was
on that
happen?
Day, the night before?
That's the only time you really knew that
then
there
I
was,
began to see.
And tell me about the night before. What were you doing that night? Did you go to bed that night, or did you stay up all
night? I was in bed.
You were in bed. Okay.
Some of the men went down to the runway, wanted to see it take off, and I do not remember how close they let them get, because I wasn't there. I was in my barracks. But a fair crowd watched the B-29 take off. But again, I don't know what they saw. Maybe they just saw an airplane.
Did you somehow know it was going to take off?
I knew somebody. I knew it was. I knew that sometime that morning that they were going to single plane was going to Japan.
Yeah.
That's all I knew.
Now, when you learned that, however you learned it, did you say to yourself, "Well, this is it. It's going to shorten the war by 2 years, whatever happens." And I think it's.
I don't think I did. I just took one day at a time.
Just one day. You didn't even think about what
the only interesting thing that happened to me is I'm asleep when my sergeant major comes and wakes me up. Saying that he has a phone call from Washington. I think I told you this over the phone. And it is up to me to get a declaration ready for Tibbetts when he came back.
Yeah.
He was on the way back from Hiroshima at this time. And I was supposed to write up his award.
Yeah.
They woke me up to do that. This came from General Arnold in Washington.
Yeah.
And
now, General,
I said, then it's something kind of important if Air Force Headquarters is going to give him a medal for this trip.
Now, General Spots was there on base, was he not?
Yes.
And he's the one that presented this...
The ribbon.
DFC or whatever it was. Yeah.
Okay. Generals came from all over the Pacific just to get their pictures in the paper. Twining, Davis.
Oh, they were all there.
I'll give LeMay credit. He didn't come.
Oh, he didn't?
No. He just...
Oh, I mean, because it was a photo op for all these other people, I guess.
LeMay didn't need it.
Yeah. LeMay didn't need it, right. What else was going on Tinian during this time? Just normal bombing missions and stuff?
Very heavy.
Very heavy bombing.
I don't know that I could say how many planes were there, but I once counted 100 in the air taking off for Japan from Tinian. And Guam and Saipan are just a few miles away, and they were all under LeMay's command. So he probably could put 1,000 planes in the air if he wanted to from those three islands.
Right.
It was beyond belief. they're flat mostly, and it was pretty easy to build runways all over the place.
Just as a little aside, did you ever know Bob Morgan by any chance? You know, the pilot of the Memphis Belle who went over there and flew Dauntless Dottie?
No, I didn't know.
Off of Tinian. I'm just curious if you happen to know. Okay, so anyway, they take off. And when you get up the next morning, you find out.
We're all down there when they land.
Oh, you're there.
Everybody's there.
And did you hear any news at all about the fact that it was successful, not successful?
Yeah.
What kind of information did they give you at that point?
I talked to Farabee when they landed.
Yeah.
And I don't know how I knew this, but I said, you said results were fair. And I got the impression we wiped out a city.
Now, how did you know that?
I can't remember now.
Were you somehow in the loop?
By now, I guess everybody knows that Hiroshima has been wiped out.
Okay, and the radio.
And I run into Farabee that morning somewhere, and I said, why did you say the results were fair? And he said, I always do. He said, you don't really know what you've done. And he said, if I say fair, well, then I don't get in any trouble later on. So that's all I knew about it. But the rumor spread all. Everybody was ready to go home by 6 o'clock that night. Everybody knew that what a terrible bomb had been.
Now, did they have a big press conference? Did you observe that and so forth?
That's when all these newspaper men shone.
Were all there, and they were allowed to come in.
Yeah.
Probably asked to go in, I guess.
Lawrence was mad because he wanted to go with them.
Uh-huh.
He thought he should go. He thought a newspaper man ought to be on there.
Oh, on the Enola Gay. He wanted to be on the boat.
They said they didn't need him. He didn't like that.
Okay, so the Enola Gay gets back, and then Tibbetts gets his DFC, and I guess a ceremony there, and the press conference and so forth. Did you get involved in any of that aspect?
Were you? I just watched it.
You're an observer at that point.
Yeah. I listened to him read my wonderful words.
Yeah, right.
I wish I had them. But
yeah, that's too bad. You don't have those.
They probably exist somewhere.
Oh yeah, they're down there somewhere, I'm sure. Okay, so then what happens on Tinian? Now this is anticlimactic.
The main thing is, what are the Japanese going to do?
Yeah, right.
And everybody, we don't know, of course. And we get reports from Washington and New York and so forth. And here's this is a simple fact that a lot of people don't know. We had only two bombs.
Right.
The third one was almost ready, but literally that we used them up.
Yeah.
And if the Japanese had not surrendered after Nagasaki, the war would have dragged on for quite a while, I'm sure. But somebody explained to them that we could drop a lot of these.
Was the Sweeney part of the 509th then?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, now, so you knew him as pretty well, too, then, along with...
Yeah, I was a good friend of Chuck.
Okay, so Sweeney was there on Tinian, and... what were the vibes then you were getting about maybe a second mission? Did you hear anything about that?
Yes, there's a little bitterness still. If you're an old military man, if the commanding officer drops the first bomb, who's likely to drop the second? Well, most of us would say the deputy commander in a case like this was Tom Klassen, a veteran of lots of battles. Mm-hmm. Of man, you ought to interview. He lives in Arkansas, but really, he had a career. He was shot down over the Pacific and spent weeks on a boat, on a raft.
Ooh, really?
Great story.
Yeah, no doubt.
I'll give you his address if you want to deal with it. Anyhow, I think most of us thought Klassen would take the next one. He didn't. Tibbetts gave it to Sweeney. who was the commanding officer of the 393rd Squadron. Oh, here's Klassen up here, here's Sweeney down here. Now, I don't know why. What's in Tibbetts' mind or anything? Anyhow, Sweeney botched it. The Nagasaki mission was not handled very well.
I know there were a lot of problems.
They just barely got back.
Yeah.
To
Not
to Tinian, but
Okinawa.
Okinawa.
Yeah.
So that's about all I know about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there the secrecy involved in that second mission?
Not near
to
as
the
much.
Degree. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Everybody knew what was going on now.
And everybody knew that. Was it kind of common knowledge that there was going to be possibly another plane going?
Yes.
I mean, was this?
Everybody had the feeling that there might be several.
Uh-huh.
We had 15 airplanes.
Yeah.
Well, what do you need 15 for if one or two bombs will do it?
Yeah.
And that was overkill, no doubt about that. Three or four probably would have been enough. But we didn't want to look too strange. And who knew how many bombs it would take? But at any rate, the third one was someplace in New Mexico, probably.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Sweeney's mission, I know. What do you know about Sweeney's mission? I've read a little bit.
All I know is what I've read. I didn't talk to him about it. Chuck was a big, swarthy Irishman who could bluff you into thinking whatever he did was right. And whatever talks I'd had with him made me think it was a great mission. But I've read since then, co-pilots and other pilots said it was badly handled, and mostly his fault, not entirely. But I know very little about it.
Yeah, okay. But in any case, then several days later, after August the 6th, the second mission
the
to
ninth.
Nagasaki. The 9th, yeah.
August the 9th.
To Nagasaki. Okay, were similar type circumstances and everything. They took off early in the morning, and was there
just a lot less
hubbub
to do? Yeah.
But I guess you felt like this might have been the coup de grace.
Yeah.
For the thing, really ending the war with that second mission. Now, when they came back, of course, they came back to Okinawa.
Right.
They were supposed to come back to Tinian, I assume, but
yes.
Couldn't make it, of course.
They were out of gas.
Yeah, out of gas, right. He barely made it, I know that. So they barely made it to Okinawa, in fact, almost ditched, I guess.
Yes.
So they were really close. Okay, so the second bomb exploded in Nagasaki, and then, of course, I know there was political machinations going on, and the Japanese still were holding back and so forth, and then finally, you got word, I guess, from your... They were still bombing, I assume. Were they still bombing, even though the...
From yes, they were. Yeah.
They're still bombing. Okay. Well, did they do any bombing after the Nagasaki
mission? I think so.
Recall.
I'm not as absolutely sure, but I've heard stories from people who said they did.
Yeah. Okay, so...
Including the Navy. The Navy was bombarding Japan thoroughly.
Okay. So what happened to you then after the Nagasaki
nothing.
Mission?
Nothing. You may have heard that the discharge system was based on points.
Right.
You got points for the months of service.
Right.
Months of overseas service.
Mm-hmm.
And children. Well, I had a boy. I had a wife, overseas service, and I had been in quite a long time.
Yeah, you had, sure had.
So it was partly my job to figure out when everybody should go home. And I magically showed up on the early list. I didn't really cheat much, but the point was, how do you get home?
Uh-huh.
And here's, what, a million men in the Pacific want to go home? How are you going to get them home with a few dozen ships? Well, the 509th had five C-54s. So I arranged to have a seat on the first one, headed back for Salt Lake City.
And what date would that have been?
This would be approximately September or October.
Oh, okay.
There was
pretty shortly
a few weeks when we did nothing.
Yeah.
Pitched horseshoes, played softball.
You're waiting for the Japanese to surrender? Or
waiting to go home.
Oh, just waiting to go home, okay. They'd already surrendered then. Yeah. Taken. Okay.
I don't remember when the Japanese surrendered. That would help. But I know quite a bit of time elapsed.
Yeah.
After August 9th.
Yeah, about a month, roughly.
I think so.
Okay. So, well, actually, what happened to the 509th then? Did they all leave, okay. I take it then? Or?
The 509th was remodeled a couple times. It went back to the States, and I've just heard this from other guys, but I think it went to New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And I read just the other day it's been reorganized. There is a 509th again.
Hmm.
Now, there's nobody in it who had been in it before,
but
it is, the number still exists.
Hmm.
And it got involved in the new bombs that were being tested in Bikini.
Okay.
It's all kind of vague in my mind because I was in school by that time.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it's more or less existed.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about Tibbetts. What was your impression of him as a man and a leader and just the guy in charge of all this?
Okay. Iron nerves, very decent, very considerate. He had enemies. By his own words, he made three or four serious enemies in the Air Force, other high-ranking officers. But anybody who worked for him loved him. He'd tell you, this is what you do, and that's it. I was very fond of him. He's laid back. I'll tell you a quick example. When the war ended, he came to see me one day and he said, you and Chuck Perry, who was the mess officer, are never going to get any credit for this war, but you've kept this outfit together. He said, you want to go to Japan? I said, sure. Well, we had to fly two Jeeps up in a C-54. And he said, you and Chuck can ride along, piggyback, with the Jeeps. Help them unload and then come on back. Get a look at Japan. Another time from Wendover, he knew that my folks lived in Oak Park and he was going to Washington. He said, you want to take a couple days leave? I'll drop you off in Oak Park and pick you up on the way back. This nice guy.
Yeah.
Good little things.
Yeah. Very considerate.
He didn't have to do.
Yeah.
I liked him a lot. Now, he's been quoted as saying he never lost a night's sleep over Hiroshima, and that's probably true. I think you were in the Air Force, were you?
No, I was in the Navy.
I think in the Air Force, the pilots, the bombardiers, and the crew get a certain sense of detachment. You know, if you're in hand-to-hand combat with a guy, that's one thing. But if you're dropping a bomb from 30,000 feet and you don't know what it does, that's something else.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to make him sound hard-hearted, but I just think that's the frame of mind that an Air Force pilot has to get.
Yeah.
He didn't know what he did.
Yeah.
All he's worried about is getting that plane back to the airbase.
Mm-hmm.
So, So I don't know if I've answered your question.
Yes, more detached than, like you say, an infantry guy for sure.
Yes.
Okay, well, what do you, and this is a kind of a philosophical question, but from what your own experience and what you've read and learned since then, I guess, how do you feel about the dropping of the bomb? It's just you know, there's all kinds of conversation about that.
Well,
as somebody who was there, what do you think?
I have mixed mind, of course. Was it necessary? Probably not. I think we would have won ultimately.
Yeah. But the cost...
Is that answering the question? Probably not. It's a terrible thing. Terrible. And I'm sorry that we did it. But on the other hand, it doesn't make a lot of difference if you're killed by a firebomb in Leipzig or one over in Hiroshima, does it? To
you're
you.
Dead. You're dead.
I don't think it does.
You're dead either way.
Doesn't make a lot of difference. And this is all speculation. If this saved thousands and thousands of lives, and we think it did, Japanese and American, then maybe it's worth it. But I'm ambivalent about it.
Yeah, it's an awful thing. But on the other hand, if you, from what I've read, you know, a million casualties on total, if we ever invaded Japan, you know. Personally, I think it was the right thing to do with my limited, you know, hindsight and so forth.
Well, war is hell. That's all it boils down to.
What did you think about the leadership that you experienced? You talked about Tibbetts, but overall, your experience in your time during World War II, what did you think about the leadership that you experienced?
I never ran into any very bad ones. I had about five base commanders at Wendover.
Mm-hmm.
I knew them all personally. And incidentally, there's a man here who's a nephew of one of them.
Really?
Briefly, mm-hmm. He was a World War I veteran, and they brought him back for a short time, discharged him. But generally, the base commanders were very competent, that I knew. The first one I had was a martinet, but he knew what he was doing. And I think I learned some things from him, how to deal with people and so on.
What to do and what not to
what
do.
What not to do, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I had one, when I was at McClellan, my commander had a habit of looking at a letter or any memo and saying, this is all wrong. And he wouldn't tell me what it was.
Well, this is a memo that you had written, or
he wouldn't tell me what was wrong.
Oh, it wouldn't tell you.
And it was my job to find it. Well, that's a pretty good management technique, because it makes for pretty perfect stuff.
Yeah, I should say.
Tibbetts was asked about my husband.
Well, Virginia, just this Tom's wife, just came in and gave me a little note here about what Paul Tibbetts said about Tom. Let me just quote this, and we'll put it in here. Tom was an outstanding adjutant. Our training was top secret, and Tom fully understood all aspects of the command, the 509th Composite Group. Hell, I don't recall ever having to tell Tom to do anything. He was so knowledgeable. He just got things done, allowing me to concentrate on other matters. I was very lucky to have Tom. Signed, Paul Tibbetts Potter. Well, that says a lot about you. That's great. I love it. What about that? Tom, just briefly digress, and it's not often that I interview somebody who's had an opportunity to meet and, you know, interact with some high-profile people. Tibbetts, of course, was a very high-profile. Did you have occasion to interact with any other what you might call high-profile people in the service?
In the service?
Yeah, primarily in service.
Well, I don't know if this quite answers your question, but I can think of only one. on my way home, I sat down with a colonel who was not a part of the 509th. Mm-hmm. Elderly, I thought.
Yeah.
And kind of distinguished looking. And we got chummy. It's a long flight. We talked a lot about one thing and another, but mostly he was interested in education.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side 2. The interview continues on tape B, side 1.
He was interested in education, you say?
Okay. And he more or less talked me into going to graduate school. Mm-hmm. See, I had graduated just before the war.
Yeah.
He persuaded me that that was important. Well, who was he? He was Colonel Stafford Warren, who was appointed by Roosevelt to supervise the uranium world for the United States. He's top supervisor to make sure that that uranium doesn't wipe out the country. And he had come just to see Hiroshima. He had just flown over, spent a couple days there, and was on his way back. He happened to be dean of the UCLA Medical School.
Mm.
And impressed the heck out of me. One trivial side point, when we got to Hawaii, we discovered we had to go through customs. We didn't know you had to do that, but we did. And since he and I were the ranking officers, we went first. He's first and I'm second. Standing in line, here's a belt. You put your suitcase on and open it up, and then these guys mess it all up. They opened his first, and right on top of his clothes was a dead rat. And he said, well, of course, the customs men jumped right. The colonel didn't bat an eyelash. He said, the officer and I have just come back from Hiroshima. We don't really know what's in anybody's baggage. And the customs man said, all right, send the whole 509th through without opening their bags.
Oh, yeah, that's funny.
But that's a...
Anybody else you can think of? Now, you observed, I guess,
I didn't meet LeMay. I just heard him yell.
Just heard him, yeah. I bet he was good at that.
The commander of the 2nd Air Force for a while, when I was at Wendover, had a volleyball team, which he would bring around to the bases with him whenever he inspected a base, because he had a good one. And we had a good one. And he challenged us one time, and we beat him. And he didn't care for that one bit. He called off the inspection and took off and went back to Colorado Springs. Travis was his name.
Yeah, okay.
Travis. But no, I just didn't know very many high-ranking men.
Yeah, you were. Well, let's face it, where you were out in Wendover Field, nobody wanted to go to Wendover, I guess, anyway. And in the 509th, things were so top secret, you couldn't get out and around.
That's why we were there.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, of course, when you heard about the Japanese surrender, you were, I'm sure, anxious, or you were happy about that, of course, but then anxious to see how you could get home, and so as you indicated, you got on.
That's all anybody talked about is, how soon can I go home?
He got one of those early aircrafts home. Do you think that the system that they used was fair, this point system and so forth, that it worked out pretty well and for the most part?
It was very difficult. You know, that we'd spent 3 years shipping men over there, and now they all want to go home the next day.
Right. Tell me a little bit about what happened to you after you went to grad school, and just kind of summarize things as to what happened to you, Tom, and how you wound up
there. I got back. Virginia had moved and was living in Buell, Idaho. And I came back on the train from Salt Lake, headed for Buell, and got to Twin Falls. And she's standing there on the platform waving at me. I didn't know she had been moved, or she had moved. And she's holding our little boy. And so we sort of set up housekeeping briefly in Idaho. But I didn't have a job, and I needed one. So I went out to Portland and got one. Everywhere I went, people said, well, go to the VA. They weren't hiring much yet, but the VA was. So I was hired as a training officer. And it was not a bad job, but I didn't care too much for it. And I could see after a year or two that those jobs would disappear. We were helping men get into college and so on. So we decided to go to graduate school. Drove down to California, went to Stanford, and talked to the people there, and enrolled in 1947, I guess, 47 or 8. And it was hard work. The two of us worked constantly.
Now, you're working on what degree, MBA or?
PhD.
PhD, okay.
She's got a library job. She's got a job with the publishers. I'm working on the playgrounds. It's our family joke that the Mercury engine never stopped. One guy would get out of a job and the other would jump into the car and go to her job. But I like Stanford a lot. I love the place. I love the people. It's a good school. It's, today it may be the best in the country. It wasn't then, probably. Or they wouldn't have let me in. And while I was just about finished, well, I had finished my PhD, when they arranged a job for me at Tulane. So in 1954, I guess it was, September, I started teaching at Tulane. And next 30 years, I taught history. Simple.
1954 till 1984, then?
74.
Excuse me.
84. What? Yeah.
Till 84, yeah. Okay, you were teaching till 84.
When I was 70.
Yeah.
They forced me out. I taught at Tulane and then at Arizona State. I retired from Arizona State.
Oh, I see. Okay. So then what brought you from there here?
Our daughter.
She lives in?
She lives in Cary.
I see. Okay.
And she and her husband did a magnificent job of studying all the places we might go, and they said this was the best one.
Okay.
For us.
So when did you actually move to North Carolina then? You retired in 84, I take it?
Oh, yes.
From Arizona State?
We lived in Texas for a while because part of our family was there. But we came here in, I'd have to ask Virginia, about four years ago.
Okay. But you lived in Texas from 84 until 2000 something.
Yeah, 2003 or two or something like that, yeah.
Okay. And so you indicated you're a happy camper here.
Yeah.
That's great. And how many children do you have?
Well, we had two, but we lost our son in an industrial accident. So, and he has two daughters whom we keep in touch with, and his widow, and then our daughter and her husband live here.
I see.
We keep in touch with them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, tell me about what do you think about what you did during the war? What's you looking back, and are you pleased with what you did? And do you feel like you?
I just sort of stood around.
And I know you didn't do that.
Things happened.
Well, things did happen to you. I have to say, you were at the right place at the right time for a little piece of history to to take place with you as an observer and a participant. So that's great. But So what do you think about that? Are you, you look back fondly on those years?
Yeah. Yes, I do. I have only one regret about my military service, which is the time.
Mm-hmm.
I lost 5 years or more.
Yeah, right. I hear that a lot from people. Yeah.
It takes you a couple of years after you get out before you get settled down.
Yeah.
In my case, it took 5 because I had to go to school too. Yeah.
So you lost time. That's.
I didn't get hurt.
Yeah.
Nobody shot at me.
But you experienced something that very few people can say your experience that you had, or something that is rare.
Yeah.
It was rare.
And I met a lot of people from all over the world. I'm a historian, which is a bad thing to be in some way. We sort of look at the world differently than other people.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'm wrong, but I spend a lot of time wondering about the world.
Well, I do too, and I'm not a historian. Well, in a way I am, but I'm like you. I do spend a lot of time wondering about
right.
this.
I worry about the world right now.
Me too.
My daughter's doing well. But our grandchildren are struggling to get by. Now, they'll make it. They're good kids and they're educated and so on. But you always assume that each generation is supposed to do a little better.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think this one is.
Yeah, well, you read a lot about that.
And it's not their fault necessarily.
Yeah. It's just a combination of circumstances.
Too much.
Above all of us.
We're paying a lot of bills.
How do you think your experience changed your life? Do you feel as though it was a world?
5 years or more. In my profession, you're supposed to write books.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wrote 6. I'm on number 7 right now. If I had had those extra 5 years, I might have written something more important.
Mm-hmm.
If I'd got started earlier, I might have done a better job. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I've always wondered about that.
Well, the lost time is significant. It's very significant to you. Did it change your outlook on life at all?
Probably.
Your experiences back then?
Probably.
I mean, after seeing what happened with the 509th and the bomb and everything else?
Yeah.
You want to watch?
I don't know what word to use. A little more worldly, a little more blasé, a little more something. you're not startled by much.
You've seen a lot. Mm-hmm. You've seen a lot, for sure. Okay, do you have anything you'd like to add before we kind of wrap this thing up? I really have enjoyed hearing your story.
No, I don't have anything else to say.
Okay.
I would suggest, if you really want a good story, get hold of Tom Klassen or Dutch Van Kirk.
Oh, I would love to. Believe me, I would love to. Who knows, maybe I'll be able to.
There's a man up in Michigan who has written a history of the 509th, pictorial type,
mm-hmm.
named Krauss, Robert Krauss. Have you heard of him?
No.
They know him down at the museum. They could give you his address if you wanted.
You talking about the World War II Museum in New Orleans, or which one you talking
here,
about?
Yeah, here.
Oh, here in the museum. Yeah, North Carolina.
I don't know what's in New Orleans. I haven't seen that. Yeah. I hear it's pretty good.
Yeah, it is. Sure is. Okay,
he could give you addresses.
Okay. Okay, I think we've kind of covered things. And Tom, I really appreciate your time today. And I know people will be interested in hearing what you have to say.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye. Glad to do it.